afternoon, and welcome to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. I'm broadcasting this afternoon, this Thanksgiving weekend, from Santa Fe, New Mexico. My friend and mentor, Dr. Kenneth J. Rahmeyer, Ph.D., DVM, XYZ, is there in the studio. He tells me it's a pleasant, if not very warm, 85 degrees in Central Texas this afternoon. It's 29 degrees here in Santa Fe with snow on the ground. Happy Thanksgiving to you, to all of our listeners, and hope you had a good Thanksgiving and this continues through this weekend. You're listening to Money Talk. This is a broadcast about the world of financial and investment planning, where we're quickly approaching our 25th anniversary every Saturday afternoon after the news at 4. The broadcast is really about the world of financial and investment planning as it affects you, and that's because you determine the agenda, as always, by calling or texting 512-836-0590. Of course, you may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com, or if you prefer, you can go there at your convenience. Just go to the website, look for the weekend hosts, and the list of podcasts of several years of Money Talk are there for your availability. A great idea to call or text at the beginning of the broadcast. We will have all of our lines available and have ready to take your text as well. So please, 512-836-0590. Kenny, at this early moment, do we have a caller or a text?
Not yet, Carl, and just appreciate all those glowing credentials. And, of course, you left out the most important one. All my postgraduate work was at the School of Hard Knocks.
Yes, and my two best teachers were trial and error. That's exactly right. Well, I got a question. I received a question last week from my friend and our longtime listener, Bob, in Arlington. And I probably can't capture the same clever and wit level that he with which he gave the question, but it was essentially, Carl, help us understand how the government spending, the government debt, the deficit spending and the government debt, how is that not like, or how is that like or unlike a Ponzi scheme? And he said he'd ask me to bloviate on that, and I was talking with someone this week who had listened to the broadcast, and he said he was looking forward to my answer. So we'll see, once he hears it, if he'll be pleased or satisfied. But for the listeners who don't pay attention to these things, the essence of a Ponzi scheme is that someone sells you an investment and promises very attractive rates of return, and then they sell the same one to the next person and the next one, and they use the money from each additional investor to pay the previous investor. So they can go through, if they're really good at this, the best in terms of dollars we've ever seen was Bernie Madoff. They can continue to this scheme by selling more and more of these bogus investments and turning around paying out to the previous investors while keeping a vast part of the money for themselves. So that's the way that is. Now, for a long time, the U.S. dollar, and I guess I don't know the history of currencies, but they were backed by something. In the U.S. dollar case, I remember as a youngster that the dollar was backed by gold. That while you couldn't necessarily go into your local bank and take $100 and get an ounce of gold or whatever it was, that it was considered directly convertible. And then I believe it was during President Nixon's administration, we went off what was called the gold standard. And so what you really have, the phrase is full faith and credit. When you have own a treasury security, for example, let's say a treasury note maturing in 8 years, there's no real credit rating on that. The theory is they don't have to pay Standard & Poor's or Moody's to get a credit rating, although they do exist, because it's the full faith and credit of the government. And we have the ability at the federal level, the phrase is print money, but it's really what's called a fiat, F-I-A-T, fiat currency. And its value is frankly determined by the global marketplace. One of the differences between the dollar, euro, yen, and compared and contrast with the Chinese yuan or renminbi, is that their government will intervene to keep their currency at a certain value compared to the U.S. dollar. So we have this luxury that most countries in the world don't have, which is we're now at an annualized rate of $1 trillion of spending, more than we're taking in from all sources, taxes and any other sources of revenues. And you and I can't do that. But it's a little bit like if you and I were given a credit card, a MasterCard or a Visa or American Express, and we were told that we had an unlimited credit. There was no amount that we couldn't charge. And oh, by the way, when it came due, we could just borrow more money to pay whatever was coming due. That's the situation when you are a government and you have control of your own currency. That's not the case for the vast majority of countries in the world. And so the only way that they can fund their deficit spending, if they have it, is by borrowing money. And frequently, the marketplace will simply either not loan them the money, or they'll loan them the money at such high interest rates that they can't do it. It'd be like you going to buy a house and discovering that rather than having a 4% mortgage, it was a 24% mortgage, you wouldn't be buying that house. So we're in a situation where sovereign debt around the world, German debt, debt of the Brits, the UK, debt of the Japanese, and ours, are trading at historic low rates. In fact, last time I saw something like $13 trillion of outstanding government debt, that would be bonds, were priced to yield less than zero. That is to say, you would buy a bond, and in 5 or 10 or 15 years, you would get back less than you originally invested. I know that's nuts, but that's the world in which we live. So the government can borrow, the U.S. government last week could borrow money for 10 years for a little less than 2%. And frankly, to Bob's answer, we can continue this forever, but actually we can continue it until global investors decide that they're no longer going to loan us money at 2%. Maybe they're going to loan us money at 3%, but if they lose confidence in the U.S. and its ability to meet its financial obligations, they might want to make 10 or 12 or 15% on their returns to loan us money. That's when the Ponzi scheme that Bob's alluding to starts to fall apart, when interest payments become so large that they crowd out other borrowing going on in the so-called productive economy, and they take a larger and larger piece of the federal budget away from Social Security or Medicare or military spending or whatever the case is. So it's not a secret. Everybody who pays attention to these things knows that we're spending more than we're taking in. We know that the Social Security system, I believe it's next year or the year after, will move into a situation where they will be paying out more benefits than they're taking in Social Security taxes. So is this a bad situation? I think common sense says it is. Now, there's a school of thought out there called monetary theory that says you can do this forever. But I would say that mainstream economists would say there will be a day of reckoning. But we just don't know when that is. And we're not being held to account. We're not being made responsible for our borrowing when we can continue to borrow at these extremely low rates. And so it's not a Ponzi scheme, but it's not a good thing. And I no more than anybody else listening, knows how long this is going to go on. But right now, the world is telling us that they'll essentially loan us whatever we need that we don't bring in from tax revenues at extremely low historic rates. So there you are, Bob. Time for me to take a break. It's also a great time for you to call or text 512-836-0590. Stick around. Kenny and I will be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. Kenny Rahmeyer's there in the studio. I'm here in Santa Fe. Call or text 512-836-0590. Kenny?
Okay, Carl. And Bob is going to be our first caller.
Bob, you're on the air. How may I help?
Hi, Carl. It's interesting. You were just talking about Social Security and the government. I will be 64 years old in late February. Mm-hmm. I sold a business 2 years ago, and so I had a large amount of income that year, but now, of course, do not have a lot of earned income.
Yeah.
And I just got a statement from Social Security saying that my monthly benefit at full retirement has probably gone down about $50 a month. So I was waiting, I'm thinking about waiting until, you know, the maximum age to start taking the benefit because I know that it grows. But with my, since I'm not having earned income, should I change that decision or stick with it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I agree with your long-held belief, which is that if you don't need the income to live on, you're better to defer taking the Social Security payment. Sadly, I've read that something approaching 50%, 50, of Social Security beneficiaries take the benefit at age 62. Now, some of them, no doubt, have to because they don't have enough income otherwise on which to live. But I had some friends in the office this week, and she said her friends were saying, well, why don't you take it at 62? You're foolish not to. I think, actually, if you're not forced to, you're foolish to take it before full retirement age. And what you're talking about for the rest of our listeners is that from full retirement age, which for most people today in their 60s is somewhere between 66 and 67 years of age, depending on their year of birth, the full retirement age is there. And then until 70, that monthly benefit grows at 8%, which is a spectacular deal. Because there's no investment that Bob or I or anybody else can make that we have a guaranteed annualized return of 8%. So it sounds to me, Bob, like it's almost going to just be a mathematical situation, and that is when you'll get that statement, and you'll know what your full retirement age benefit is. And it'll tell you what your 70 is. Or you think that next year when you get the statement, because of the way your income has happened, that it'll drop another $50 a month?
Probably so, yes.
So that'd be $600 a year. So, you know, my sense is, because it's a unique circumstance, if you don't need the money, I'd wait one more year, and then you'd find out what your full retirement age is, and then you find out what your 70 is, and then you can say, well, you know, it's dropping at a rate faster than I could offset by growth in waiting. It's really a mathematical decision. If you assume you live to your normal life expectancy, there aren't any other extenuating circumstances like poor health or a chronic life-shortening disease, I'd give it another year. Look at the difference between waiting to full retirement age and waiting till 70. And if it's not dropping off a cliff, you know, I'd probably kick the can down the road.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Kenny.
Yes, Carl. Ed is our next caller.
Ed, you're on the air. How may I help?
Hey, Carl, how are you today?
Good.
Good. And you're in Santa Fe. What a deal.
I am. Yeah, it's extremely cold.
Oh, wow. Well, here's my question. This week in the Wall Street Journal, I happened to read an article, and I didn't really realize this was going on, but there are companies out there that are buying up oil royalties from individuals.
Yeah.
And they're packaging them and, I guess, selling them back to investors through you investing in those companies. There's one called Kimball Royalty Partnership.
Yeah.
And according to the article, it's undervalued. And according to the article, they're paying about 10%. And I'm wondering what you know about these companies, what the risks are in your mind to having a portion of that in your portfolio.
Yeah. Great question. Well, I don't know anything about the company specifically, but you sound like an intelligent fellow who reads the Wall Street Journal. First of all, you have to assume that they've put some smart actuarial experts. They have some sense of the remaining capacity for the length of time and the decline over time of those royalties. They've then taken some kind of discount against that and plugged in a profit for themselves and then pay it out. but it is a wasting asset because it's a royalty on hydrocarbons, and those are not perpetual. Consequently, they deserve to be priced with a lower price and a higher yield, because to some degree, that income you're receiving is a return of your own investment. There may even be some tax benefits to that. The outlook, frankly, for rising royalty is fairly dim this afternoon, and a lot of the big companies are starting to face political pressure, particularly I was reading today in Barron's in Europe. Companies like British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell are starting to get a lot of pressure because of the environmental and climate change risks associated with hydrocarbon production. So if you did this, it would go into the speculative portion of your portfolio. It's not a bond. It's not a stock. It has more characteristics like a stock than a bond. About the only thing I would say that would make it bond-like would not be a good thing, and that is if interest rates were to rise over time, there could be downward pressure on the value of this simply because interest-sensitive, yield-oriented securities are negatively related to interest rates. As rates rise, they tend to drop in value. So the two risks, three risks I can identify is the price of the underlying hydrocarbons. So it's a call on, it's a prediction on oil and gas values. Secondly, it's a depreciate, not depreciating, it is a disappearing asset, so it deserves a high payout. And third, you do have interest rate risk. So you don't know the duration, you don't know how long the stream is going to last, and you have these other external features. And so for the average person, it sounds too speculative for me. But if you're okay with all of that, and you want to put 2 or 3% of it in your portfolio, be my guest, but it does not sound like something that I'd be really comfortable with.
Excellent, excellent answer, Carl. I appreciate that, and I'll factor all that in and make a decision out of it. Thank you so
Terrific.
Much for your insight.
You bet. Great. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. I'm Carl Stewart. Call or text Kenny and me at 512-836-0590. Kenny, ICE show is 429. I'm reluctant to get into another conversation either with you or on a text or with a caller. So let me just get to this, and just in case you're tuning in, we're here for another half hour. Kenny Rahmeyer in Austin. I'm here in Santa Fe. It's always a good time during a break to call or text 512-836-0590. Stick around for the second half of Money Talk. Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart. You're listening to News Radio KLBJ. My friend Kenny Rahmeyer is there in the studio helping me. I'm broadcasting this afternoon from Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're off to a great start with some good questions. We're halfway through our broadcast. If you've been thinking of calling or texting, this would be a good time to do so. The number, as always, is 512-836-0590. You may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com or go there and download podcasts of several years of Money Talk. Kenny?
Okay, Carl. Ed? No, it's Scott. Scott is our next caller.
Okay, terrific. Scott, you are on the air. How may I help?
Well, first, Carl, I wish I was in Santa Fe with you. Is there snow on the ground?
We had... we came up Tuesday, and we had yesterday, we were watching a football game, and the weather was so rough, and the wind was so strong, and the snow, that the cable went out for a while. But now the sun is shining, and there's snow all over the ground.
Well, you picked a great place to be, is all I can tell you.
Thank you.
Secondly, I've listened to you since the first day that you have been broadcasting.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, thank you for your service to all of your listeners. You're just a great source of information for us.
Thank
all.
You. Thank
My
you.
Question is, I'm a 36-year state employee. I'm contemplating retirement soon. And my question is about ERS. What is your opinion about their investment strategies? Are they good? And the reason why I ask is my wife has a longevity strain in her family, thank God. She will probably have to be 100 years old, and I'm going to choose to give that benefit to her after I retire. So if you could just comment on
Yeah.
ERS, and because I've read some things that, you know, sometimes they don't stack up well to other state retirement systems.
Yeah. Well, it's a terrific question, and for the rest of our listeners, what we're talking about is what's called a defined benefit plan. For many, many years after World War II, these were very common in both the public and private sector. So if you were a longtime employee of, like Ed is, of General Electric or Procter & Gamble or Coca-Cola or 3M or IBM, you had, if you qualified by working a certain length of time, that you had lifetime income. I know my father worked for an investor-owned electric utility, and the combination of his Social Security benefit and his defined benefit pension payment, this shows you how long ago it was. Now, our younger listeners won't get this, but he retired and he went from driving Chevrolets to driving Oldsmobiles. So it was a great thing. They have virtually disappeared in the private sector. And the reason is that they're remarkably expensive in this regard. You put money in, but you don't take the decision-making process, and the liability lies with the employer. They've made a binding promise. They've taken money out of your paycheck. They've made contributions. They've made investments. And if the investment returns don't meet their objectives, it's their liability. Now, in the private sector, occasionally, and this happened, for example, spectacularly in the commercial airline industry, there would be defined benefit plans, and then the airline would go bankrupt. And those pension benefits and pension liabilities would go to something called the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which was a government agency that was funded by these various pension plans, and they would pay out a lifetime income, but they were capped at some modest level compared to what some of the senior pilots had been receiving in the pension. We now see defined benefit plans really strong, frankly, in the public sector, firefighters, police officers, city, county, state employees, and also school teachers. The difference here is you're with the Employee Retirement System of Texas, which is a state that is growing. As you know, 100 people a day are moving into the Central Texas area. And what that means is while the demands for state services go up, it also means that revenues are coming into the state as well. You're not in the situation that, say, some teachers are in the Chicago school district or some police officers were in Detroit. It doesn't mean it's risk-free, because I've read that the pension system for the police officers in Dallas is under a lot of stress. Here's where politics comes in. And you know this from being a longtime employee, maybe not intentionally because you were a young man at the time, but you essentially made a bargain when you went to work as a state employee. You were never going to get rich, but you were going to have good benefits. You were going to have good employer-sponsored health care. And if you worked there long enough, you were going to have lifetime income. It didn't matter whether the economy soared or went into a recession, or if the stock market soared or went into a bust, you were still going to get your benefit. Everything I've read would indicate to me that the two big statewide pensions, which would be the Teachers Retirement System of Texas and the Employees Retirement System of Texas, are in excellent shape, and they're in good management hands. Now, they certainly don't necessarily hit the top in terms of their investment returns every year, but I've known enough about what they've done that they are prudent investors with your money. They are broadly diversified. And the other thing I would say is that it would be a remarkably politically, how shall I put this, unthinkable is a bad term, but it would be catastrophic for the state to break its promises. Now, what could happen, and I don't think this will affect you whatsoever or people in your age cohort, it's certainly plausible over the next 25 to 45 years that the state will look at that liability and say, you know, We've got to address this, and they could change the funding in a way that reduces the benefit. They could make a qualification or eligibility take more time. But for people in your age cohort who have paid into it, I'm frankly extremely comfortable I would not, if I were in your shoes, lose a moment of sleep. That benefit will do anything but be exactly what is promised for both you and if you set up the benefit the way you're going to for your surviving spouse. So if I'm in your shoes, I'm feeling comfortable about it.
Well, thank you, Carl. The one thing that does give me some hope is that the legislators, the members of the Texas legislature, their benefit is tied to ERS also. So if there's a problem, yeah, I would think that they would fix that too. So
Right. I completely agree with you. I mean, this is a problem that if it happened would cut deeply for a lot of people, including the legislature. So I think I agree with your analysis there. Okay?
All right. Thank you so much, Carl. Appreciate your work.
Okay. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. I'm Carl Stewart. Give Kenny and me a call or text at 512-836-0590. Kenny?
Well, Carl, as we wait for that next text or phone call, tomorrow is the 1st of December. It's that time of year when maybe we could ask you for some explanation of mutual funds and taxation of capital gains in mutual funds.
Good. Yes. And I will do this, and I realize it's 4:42, and if I get bloviating along and it's taking longer than two or 3 minutes, I'll just interrupt myself. This comes up every year, and where it gets to be a concern is that you've owned a mutual fund this year and the year before, and this year you've had a very attractive return if it's a stock fund, but you didn't sell any shares, and you get your 1099 after the first of the year, typically in January or February, and you have a taxable event from your mutual fund, and you say, how in the world do I owe taxes when I never sold a share of the fund? And the answer is, this is how it works. Mutual funds are required to distribute, that is, pay out net realized capital gains. What do I mean by that? Well, in some ways, they're in the same boat as you and I are. They close out their books typically in September or October, as I understand it. Let's say it's a stock fund. They take all of their transactions for the year, stocks they sold for a gain, stocks they sold for a loss. If they sold more for a gain than they did for a loss, that's a net gain, they have to pay that out to you, the shareholder. Most people, wisely, in my opinion, reinvest those capital gains. Now, two things happen when you do that. Your cost basis, which is what you paid for the fund, is increased by that reinvested capital gain. That's good, and I'll get into that a bit later. But it's still a capital gain. And even though you didn't receive cash, it is indeed your liability. Obviously, if you owned this in a tax-deferred account like an IRA or Roth IRA, you're not going to have to pay taxes on it. But that is the way the taxation goes. Also, even though it's not capital gains, if the fund had stocks that paid dividends or a bond fund that owned bonds that paid interest, that also is subject to the same rule, which is that the fund has to pay out those dividends and capital gains, and you will pay taxes on it. That's just the way that it is. For most people, it's not a big deal. If you really do your own investments or you have an advisor, you can ask her or you can look at the historic capital gains distributions from funds you either own or considering owning. There'll be some that pay more than others. But there's a real attempt in most actively managed funds to not pay capital gains at any excessive level. And in so-called passive or index funds, they frequently can go for a long time without having to pay any capital gains. It's a little complex, but the reason we're talking about it here this afternoon is you really want to make sure that you don't have a big and unpleasant surprise when you get your 1099 after the first of the year. When we come back, if we don't have a call or a text, I'll talk about the benefits of reinvesting capital gains. A good time to call or text would be right now at 512-836-0590. Kenny and I will be right back after this. Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Kenny Rahmeyer's there in the studio. I'm here in Santa Fe. We've got another 10 minutes together. If you have a question or call or text, 512-836-0590. Kenny.
Okay, Carl. Philip is our next caller.
Philip, you're on the air. How may I help?
Good afternoon, Carl. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I sure can. Please go ahead.
Great. Long-time listener, I appreciate all you do. So I'm about to turn 60 next year, and I went through a divorce a couple of years ago, so I've been rebuilding my savings in my retirement accounts as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. I've always looked at Social Security sort of as a gigantic bond, and have never really put much of my 401k or IRA money in bond or bond funds. Is that a good strategy, in your opinion, or is it a little mixed up? I have other assets like life insurance, cash values that I've built up over the last 40 years, so it's just sort of another leg on the stool or the chair of my retirement account.
Yeah.
I wondered your opinion.
Yeah. I think from a purely objective standpoint, putting aside toleration for risk and trying to rebuild your retirement savings and investments after the divorce, it is absolutely reasonable to look at your Social Security as a giant bond fund, because you could say, well, if my Social Security benefit is $1,500 a month, how much would I have to put into bonds yielding 2 or 3% to get that kind of income? It's a big number, particularly with interest rates at these low levels. And the big risk to the retiree is running out of money. And the second big risk is a rising cost of living after you no longer are working, so that the things that you buy and use get more and more expensive, but your income does not. And Social Security it has no real, I mean, they have an inflation adjustment, but I would not count on that. So you look to your mutual stock funds in your retirement plan or in your own personal investing outside your retirement plan as a place to build assets and also to give you some protection from declining purchasing power once you retire. Now, let's feed back in the piece that I intentionally left out. It really takes, in my opinion, a pretty high level of self-awareness to follow through on this. There's a lot of work in the area called behavioral finance, which posits that people, and not just 2 or 3%, but people, by and large, the way we're wired is that if we have a 10% gain, we experience it as a 10% gain, and if we have a 10% loss, we experience it as a 20% loss. And also, we have something called recency bias. So if we've gone through a bear market like we did twice in the first decade of this century, that really colors people's views about risk. If you're a person who can live through what sadly is inevitable, a large drop in the stock market, so that you get the good long-term returns, then you're thinking, in my view, is absolutely just spot on. I have a friend who has a defined benefit plan, and he's now in his early 80s, and he's had an all-stock fund allocation for the 25 years that I've known him, because his view is his pension, which he knows is sound, and Social Security are his bond investment, and his stock investments for the reasons I said. So if you fit into that category where you can live with the swings, then I think being more aggressive with stock funds in your 401k is absolutely the right thing to do.
That's great. I appreciate that. Yeah, one thing I've always done is if the market's gone crazy high, like this year where I'm up, you know, like 20%,
right,
I take money off the table as it moves up. So I may sit on 10, 20, 25% cash. So if there is a big drop off, I have an investment opportunity, but I never really go higher than that because I'm looking at the long-term potential.
Exactly. Well, that's a form of rebalancing, which is perfectly reasonable. And again, you may be one of the small minority of people who can put aside fear and greed and simply do that on an objective basis. And if you can, I think that's a terrific strategy.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate all you do.
Okay. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Kenny?
Yes, sir. Roger is up next.
Roger, you're on the air. How may I help?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I had a question about concerning a defined benefit plan that I'm lucky enough to have at my employment.
Uh-huh.
And looking at retirement after 31 years.
Uh-huh.
I'm 58 and wondering about taking a lump sum versus the defined plan. And
sure.
I wanted to see what you thought about that.
Sure. And will you also, when you reach full retirement age, which is a decade from now, will you be also eligible for Social Security, Roger?
I will be. However, lost a spouse several years ago. I have not remarried, so I actually can draw against her earnings at age 60, as early as age 60.
And then you will have a benefit of your own when you hit full retirement age?
Yes, I will. That will be higher than the one proposed on my late spouse.
Yeah. So let's argue this both ways because it's really, really important. I've got about 4 or 5 minutes here before the end of the broadcast.
Yes.
The argument for doing this is it takes 100% of the investment risk off the table because your employer or their designate are making investments to fund their liability, which is your asset of lifetime income. You don't have to worry about the stock market, the bond market, interest rates, currencies, who's in the White House, tariffs, trade policy, and none of that because you've got that monthly check coming in. Creates for some people a huge sense of comfort. Taking it at a young age as you were considering it does have one meaningful risk, and that is if you live your life expectancy and you posit a 2 or 2.5% annual inflation rate, that's the future value of that stream of income will diminish over time because it's not going to go up from the defined benefit plan and your cost of living likely is.
Yes.
If you're a person, like I was visiting with the last caller, who can live with these 50% declines that happen periodically in the stock market, and you want to have your own portfolio because you have the time and the interest to do it yourself, or because you have an advisor who you have confidence in, I'm not opposed to that. It really comes down to, for many people, a real situation of comfort. I think if you'd ask someone today, after 10 years of the financial crisis in the rearview mirror, some people might be more inclined to take the lump sum. If you'd ask the same pool of people a year, in 2010 or 2011 after the financial crisis, I would predict more people would take the defined benefit. So I think you really have to look in the mirror metaphorically and say, if I take this lump sum, which is a big number, and I put 60% of it in the stock market, and the stock market drops 50%, that portfolio is going to drop 30% if the bonds stay flat. Can I live with that kind of downside risk? And if the answer is, I think that's not, and put it in dollar terms, not just percentages like I have. If that's $500,000 and it drops $150,000, how am I going to be about that? And you have to be coldly, not objective, but you just have to really know yourself. And if you're not that, if that sounds like something that's not tolerable for you, do not take the lump sum. Lastly, if you talk to people about taking a lump sum and they start giving you guarantees and attractive rates of return, run as fast as you can in the other direction because real estate, stocks, and bonds are at historic highs, and thinking that you're going to get 8 or 9% on your portfolio over the next decade, in my personal opinion, is way too optimistic. So long-winded answer, major, major question, but that's how I would think about it if I were in your shoes.
Okay. Do we still have a minute?
We got about a minute. Please go ahead.
It's about $230,000 versus $1,600 a month.
So you take $1,600 a month times 12.
Yeah.
That gives you the annual. You take that and divide it by the $238,000. And then you plug in, and you're not going to be able to find that kind of return someplace else. And you're going to get that the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. That's what you have to think about.
And Carl, you have about 20 seconds to wrap
it up. Okay, I'm going to have to finish it there, Roger. I wish you the best of luck, and thanks for calling. In my last 15 seconds, I want to thank, because it's a period of Thanksgiving, I want to thank Patrick. I want to thank Kenny for his long service, putting up with me and me teasing him about being the world's smartest man. I want to thank our listeners for your continued loyalty. Thanks so much for listening. And next Saturday, after the news at 4, be sure and tune in to Money Talk.